Non, j'entends rien.
Ouais. Là, j'ai l'enregistrement est parti.
D'accord.
Bon, je vais essayer de t'aller pas en okay. retour à la con.
Alexandre. En fait, ce que je vais dire au début va être probablement, même certainement, de peu d'intérêt pour toi. Par contre, la dernière partie, c'est d'intérêt pour tous les représentants des organisations. Et je ne l'aurais pas précisé, je ne l'aurais pas dit. Est-ce que tu pourrais essayer de les ramener?
Il y en a deux qui sont là.
Moi, je n'ai ramené.
On a dit qu'ils doivent être avec Robin, peut-être.
Et, ouais.
Il a toute la compta.
Mais ceci dit, il y a le temps, hein, parce qu'il y a le temps que j'explique tout ça. Mais si tu peux essayer de les rassembler, de leur dire de venir d'ici un quart d'heure, une demi-heure, ce serait bien. On y va? Tout le monde est prêt?
Okay. La fin dans l'anglais?
Yes, I must do this in English.
Et tu vas peut-être lever le...
Ah,
ça va être dur pour toi.
Yeah. I must do this in English because most of the people dealing with the EUCD in other countries, in other European countries, not just France, came here and they do not speak French. And I would like them to hear the second part of my speech. The first part being a more an introduction to the EUCD and the problems it triggers, which may or may not be familiar to all of you, and is of not interesting for them, but the second part is very important for them, for us all, and for the fight against the nasty effects of the EUCD. So I'm kind of talking in the name of all these organizations here, listed here, all of them representing 13 countries in Europe, where someone, at some point, decided that something should be done to counter the wrong effects of what we can call a European law, although it is a directive, so it's not exactly a law, but it, in effect, and that's what I'm going to show and to try to demonstrate, it has the same effect as a law, national law. So all of them at some point in their respective countries decided that something needed to be done. No one was doing anything, the newspaper didn't talk about the EUCD, and the government was passing a new law that was harmful to them and to their friends. So they needed to do something, they motivated themselves. And in 13 countries this happened. In addition, a Europe-wide organization, which is called EDRI, was started last year, did not gain momentum yet, but also has the goal to address the EUCD, among other things. For those who were here this morning, IP Justice presented the effects of the DMCA and explained that Robin Gross decided to go international to fight against that kind of laws, to fight at an international level and not just in a specific country. So I will start with an introduction to the EUCD, starting by the perspective of France. So in France, I was one of these 13 guys who decided to do something because nothing was done in France. In last December, a law project was disclosed to the press. It was not really meant to be secret, but it was not published. But the newspaper got the law project and started the thread for private copy. They claimed that it was a shame that the new law would forbid, in fact, anyone to do a private copy where it's now lawful. And since before that event, about nothing was done, no organization was fighting against the EUCD, the translation of the EUCD in national law, I felt compelled to do something. What we did in the past 8-9 months was to publish legal proposals to counter the wrong effects of the EU city in France. For that, we proposed a better, more precise definition of technical measures, because it's too fuzzy as it is. We don't know exactly what it is. It could cover about everything. And what we recently published is an in-depth study of French penal law that explains that technical measures are already protected by French law, which means that possibly we could say we comply to EU CD already. We do not need to change the law. But anyway, you need to change the law when there is a directive. But you can change it minimally. And you can change it not by changing the droit d'auteur, but by changing penal code, which is much less harmful for various reasons. I will not go into details. In order to do that, we had to raise money. Because there were no pro bono lawyers willing to spend enough time in the time frame to produce these documents, to produce these proposals. Mm. And so the public decided to give about 27,000 euros to fund this effort. Now I must say that we've been heard, that's right, but the influence we had, I'm still looking for it. I'm not sure. The government was planning to publish the law in January 2003. Well, it was not published. It was postponed until September. So maybe we helped in that respect. But we're not sure. In any case, none of the proposition we've made, concrete proposition we've made, has been even relayed in official documents or official reports. So the influence we had was, at best, small. So this is my small, I do it half an hour, something like that usually, but I will compress that in 15, 10 minutes if I can, about what EUCD is. You probably, who never heard about EUCD? You never?
You
well, pardon?
You succeeded.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently, well, yeah. Yeah. In the community, the influence of EUCD.info was instrumental, I think. But the influence that people have over the government is, well. Okay, so I will just outline the specific points that are of importance regarding the EUCD, not going into much detail. First, it's not a new fight. Victor Hugo, in his time, 150 years ago, already had to fight against what was called at that time le cercle des libraires. Now we don't have the le cercle des libraires anymore, but we have the majors. And as the Cercle des Libraires 150 years ago, they also claimed that they need money in order to fund intellectual creation, that we need protection, and without that, nothing will happen. So the fight is not new. The Cercle des Libraires has been replaced by majors, but also proprietary software publisher. The one who make the DRM, the TCPA, all the production measures, all the technical measures you can imagine. They are the software publisher, proprietary software publisher. They are the one who sold to the majors the ludicrous idea that they will be able to protect their work thanks to their technology, where they do not themselves protect their own work with the same technology. So they found someone ready to pay, and they managed to convince them to pay a lot of money for something they wouldn't use for themselves. And so the debate is about funding intellectual work. However, it's not exactly what it does. You know that movies on DVDs are scrambled. And in order to view them, you have to descramble them. This system is often called CSS, which is mixing kind of two things. The fact that the movie is scrambled and the fact that you control access to the movie, which are two different things. DCSS is merely a software that descrambles the movie, does not control access to the movie, does not tell you whether you can copy or not copy. It just descrambles the movie. That's all it does. In that respect, it's an alternate product of a part of a proprietary software that implements CSS. So that kind of software is definitely lawful regarding interoperability. As a matter of fact, I would even go as far as to argue that any technical measure can be sliced in parts where you can lawfully replace one part at the low level under the name of interoperability, like DSS does. Because of this property of software, that you can slice it in small pieces, and because there is always someone to circumvent a technical measure, in the late 80s, people who were frantically implementing technical measures decided to give up. They were punching holes on diskettes. They were putting dongles everywhere. They were actively searching for the absolute technical measure that would never be defeated. And they realized in the late 80s that it was not doable. So they gave up. And in the 90s, the internet appeared with a lot of content, absolutely not protected by any technical measure. Definitely a revolution, definitely a gain for intellectual workers. They had no technical measure to protect their works, but they had the law, which was apparently enough. So what's the point if it's not useful for that, if it will be defeated anyway? Obviously, it makes a lot of money for proprietary software vendors. I mean, really a lot of money. But for a lawful user, what does it mean? I mean, if you bought a film or a CD with music on it, and you want to listen to it, you have the right to listen to it. If you have to circumvent a technical measure, you've done nothing wrong. Especially, you've done nothing wrong to the author of the music. You've paid what you had to pay. So there's nothing wrong on that. Now, if you're a bandit, if you're a multi-million firm in China, decided to press millions of CD and then to sell them on the black market, the fact that you will, in addition to this, which is unlawful, circumvent a technical measure does not make you more guilty or less guilty. So it does not make a difference. It does not make a difference for lawful use. It does not make a difference for counterfeit. But it's not a matter of defending authors' right. It's not a matter of prohibiting people from doing circumvention. It's a matter of enforcing control. On what? On the software used to access intellectual works. Because when you buy a license to the CSS consortium, in order to use their technology with their approval, you have to sign a contract that has nothing to do with the author, nothing to do with the user. It has to do with your relationship as a software vendor with the maker of, or the controller of the technical measure. And what will it do? he will forbid you to write a software that skips advertisement at the beginning of the DVD. This is one example. But in fact, a contract between the software vendor and the CSS consortium could do about everything. So authors and users are clearly out of the loop, and majors and publishers of software are in control, totally in control. That's what it's about. So when I explained that to the Ministry of Cultures and a bunch of lawyers, they open round eyes and tell me, where did you see in the text of the EUCD or even in the law proposal any mention of a new monopoly over technical measures? We didn't say that anywhere. Sure. But if it's not a monopoly, then DCSS is lawful, because it's just an alternate product implementing part of the technical measure. Now, if it's unlawful, you cannot deny that it means the people who control the technical measure have indeed control over all the software implementing the technical measure. So you have to choose. There is a dilemma here. What's true? What's right? What will you rule? Well, they did not answer directly. But then I point out that if the text of the directive is so complex that very famous lawyers in France have been working on it during 2 years, and all of them claimed that it was not understandable. Well, if it was said in the directive that what is the intention is to grant a monopoly to people inventing technical measures, then it would be two lines and everything would be said. But the drawback is that we would have to carefully evaluate how much it costs to society to grant this monopoly. And this is something they do not want. So this is my small introduction to EUCD. Certainly partial, there are a lot more to say about it, but I hope it was an angle you don't hear all the time. Now what I'm going to try to address, and this is very new for me, and I'm happy that members of organizations fighting EUCD are here now, is how are we going to fight this from now on? We've acted at the national level. What's next? We find ourselves in this position because in 1996, a treaty was signed by various countries that does not, as Robin Grass explained this morning, that does not impose EUCD to countries who signed it, but that give an excuse to write the EUCD or the DMCA. What were we doing in 96 when that was mentioned? And even if we were carefully looking, probably could we envision the fact that this wording, this specific wording of the treaty would be interpreted as an excuse to write outrageous laws? Maybe not. And then, before falling to France, it falls to Europe. That is, although France signed the treaty, France has not been working in the past years to implement the treaty. Europe did. Europe worked on that. And it was a fierce fight, I heard, because I was not there. And they came up with a directive, which I call informally a law. And then the directive at the end of last year became imperative to states. That is, in theory, you could claim the directive for a court case. You could say, these people are violating the directive, although it was not implemented, I claim that they are violating the directive. It should be implemented now. The state is late, and I want my rights to be enforced regarding this directive. So it has some power. It's a bit complex, so people don't actually do it. And the states slowly translate this directive into national law. So you can rely on the fact that international treaties are not enforced. That is, if something is written in an international treaty, you can argue that it's written there and that the law is not compliant to this, and that a court case that is against you is not fair, but you will not win on this basis. And in practice, I don't know any case, probably a rare case exists, where you claim that an international treaty says that and you win a court case. European directives are enforceable, but they are not enforced in practice because it's a bit too complex. And when it becomes national law, at that time, it's enforced. So, as I said, Europe may use international treaties as excuses. And the EU CD was written in this way. What happens when it's translated in national law is that it's not an excuse they use. They say, we must comply. We have no choice. When I heard that first, I couldn't believe it. Does it mean that French law is indeed written in Europe? Well, apparently it does. If lawmaking people tell you they have no choice, although the texts say, when implementing in national law, you must interpret the text of the directive. You must grasp the spirit and arrange your law so that it matches the spirit, not the letter. But they even gave up this freedom of creating laws that match national specific history or preferences. So it appears to me that the making of national laws is fading, that we're not making laws at the national level. Some examples of what I faced when lobbying in France. By lobbying, I mean, in the noble sense, providing information to people and not aggressively telling them, you must do that, you must do that, or I will kill your daughter.
Or bribing them.
Or bribing them. No, I won't do that. No, don't have enough money. So the first answer from the person responsible of the translation at the Ministry of Culture was exactly that. You're a pain if you bug us too much. We will just cut and paste the directive into national law and then ha ha ha, you will have lost everything. Well, apparently they don't care what they lose. And another one was when we claimed that we should have access to documents, we should have access to proposal, law proposal, we should be invited to meetings where details were discussed. First, we proved useful. We wrote a report, we brought it to them, we proved to be consistent in our approach, not aggressive. We did everything we could diplomatically. Then we kindly asked to be invited in these meetings. And they answered that, yes, the work you're doing is really great, but keep doing it without any information. It's much harder and you have much more merit. And the last one is, and it was said over and over, we have no choice. We must implement this directive. And we have to do it fast. Otherwise, we will be sued, regardless of the fact that some directives that do not please the government are 15 years late, and they never pay anyway. Also, something we tried, an angle we tried, is to have our government people cooperate with other government people. Obviously, the people who were on our side, although they are few in France. We tried that with Portugal, trying to put them in contact. We identified someone and say, well, you could call him, he's dealing with the same subject. They have no interest whatsoever in talking to each other. It's a purely top-down approach. And they talk to Europe, they think by themselves when they think, and that's it. Where one prominent goal of European directives is to harmonize European laws. So you would think that at least their lawyers, not the person responsible who is really busy, but the lawyers would try to figure out how they will implement it in other countries in order to be in conformance, in order to have an harmonized system. No way. So it's pretty much a failure. Then I wondered if it wouldn't be more useful to do lobbying at the European level. After all, it's about the same process. Okay, a directive is definitely a law in disguise. The interpretation part, interpretation freedom of the states, is so thin in practice that a directive is a law. What you see in the directive will be in your law. So why not act at this level? And it works pretty much the same way. And at some point, you have a directive proposal that is made by some people. It's made public at some point. You can comment on it. And at some point, it's voted by deputies, much in the same way as in France. The law will be voted at the end of the year, beginning of next year, by our deputies. And the good aspect of it is that Europe is independent. That is, they may be influenced by large lobbies, companies, etc., but they do not claim to be forced to write specific laws because they have to legally. They use excuses as treaties, okay, but they do not give you the argument that they cannot do otherwise. So they have this freedom, and apparently the states, although they probably have it, they gave up. So I wonder if I did the right thing by doing EUCD.info. Probably I should have made our European-wide action first. And this is where cooperation matters, because acting at the European level is much harder than acting at the national level in the States, for instance. Because there is the language problem. This is a real problem. And there are distances. I mean, all the initiatives we know are pretty much done by people living in the same place and speaking the same language. Mostly, they are not too far apart. There is something in common. So in order to have a Europe-wide action, you cannot just assume that someone will say, I do an initiative that is Europe-wide, because this person won't be able to talk all the languages. He won't be able to talk to the fine people in every country. That is unlikely to work. In fact, it does not work currently. What happens is what we see now. So we have to deal with cooperation. We cannot envision a Europe-wide structure made by a few people lobbying Europe. We have to deal with cooperation. So we have to face the cooperation dilemma that is made of independence and individualism first. What triggers people to do things is that they feel compelled for some reason to do it, and they can do it on their own. They have the mean to do it. They do it their way, which is probably not exactly the way someone else will do it, although they share the same goal. They will do it differently. And maybe they will do it exactly the same way, but they are in control. And that's something we like, even if we're not control freaks, but just we like to be independent, which is kind of, I want control over my life, over my actions, over my lobbying. So volunteers all have this tendency. And we, in the 13 countries, we all have our way to deal with the problem. We didn't have to ask anyone how to do it. We did it our way. And also, you do not see much volunteers doing lobbying or doing things if they do not feel needed for some reason. In the case of law, I doubt a volunteer will go spontaneously to legal subjects just for the fun of it. So in our case, yeah, except maybe Robin or Martin, but okay, that's two exceptions, maybe three. But mostly, you feel you have to do it because no one is doing it. If you imagine that you have a structure at the European level, what will be left of that? You say, well, someone else is doing it. Probably. So if even if it's not enough, even if this person needs help, say, at least he's doing a good job and I will maybe deal with other subjects. The asset we have currently, which is enormous, 13 initiatives in 13 European countries, I think it wouldn't have been the same number of people if it was only one organization, because all these people felt needed in their own country because nobody was addressing the problem. That's my case. So the problem here is this is what triggers volunteers to do things, and if we cooperate, you lose independence. So there is something contradictory. You like to volunteer, but you need to be independent. If you cooperate, you lose independence. You're maybe not willing to do that. If someone else is addressing the problem, then you do not feel needed. Sorry if it's not too fluent, but I hope you get the point. So I have three points, proposals to solve this dilemma. Not in general, but for EU City specifically, to try to fight EU City. First, something that I identify as crucial is to have a common goal that is simple, well-defined. Some would say stupid. This is a paradigm we use much in programming. You cannot solve all problems at once. You need to exactly find what you should do and put borders on it and try not to cross them. Otherwise, you got lost and it's a big mess. In the case of program, it means the program will never work for anyone. In case of lobbying, it means you will not convince anyone. So defining the simplest useful task for EUCD.info, it was fighting the EUCD and nothing else. Of course, there are a lot of other issues to be addressed, privacy, competition, etc. But we address all of them only if they relate closely to EUCD. We fight EUCD. We do not fight the next directive. We do not fight the previous directive. We only fight this one. We try to do it well. That does not mean that having an organization whose task is to fight the EUCD with broader goals is wrong. It's only that we define a specific goal. As a matter of fact, the very reason we are here from various countries is because we fight EUCD. Our common ground is not fighting for more privacy or fighting or even fighting for free software. It's fighting the EUCD. That's why we met yesterday and today. That's what binds us. The second part is to get information flowing, to have access to information. There are basically, in every organization, two typical attitudes. The first one is the most typical. That is, you decide that everything you do is secret by default. And you only choose to disclose what you decide should be public. And most organizations work this way. The other way is to decide that everything is public by default, and that you decide on a case-by-case basis that something is really sensitive and should not be disclosed. It's an equilibrium. That is, just 2 points. If you apply rule A, the drawback is that you're guaranteed that a volunteer willing to jump into the fight will not be provided with the proper material to work with. He will most likely come to you and say, okay, I'm a volunteer, what should I do? Where if you have a flow of raw information available, he will watch it for 2 months and figure out by himself where it can be useful. It also brings the feeling of being needed. It also pushes the feeling of being needed, because a secretive organization always looks like there is a lot of people behind it. They are doing wonderful things. They must be so bright. There must be so many. They don't need me. When you have a feed of raw information, you see that it's only a few people, that they are not smarter than you, and that they definitely need your help. And of course, the drawback of B is that your enemies can use the information against you. So it's an equilibrium. You have to choose.
Yeah, but the enemy is not quite your enemy.
Well, the enemy tends to be very secretive, always. Ça fait combien? J'en suis à combien, là? Pardon? 46. Good. Almost finished. And then, and that's why I wanted people from various organizations here fighting the UCD to be there. My proposal is to have a name. The question is, what brings something into existence? Au commencement était le verbe, at the beginning was the verb, but I don't know if it's the way it's said in English. Sorry?
The word.
The word, okay. So we could make something exist just by naming it. Do we have something to name? I'd say definitely yes. What brings us together here today is the fact that we fight EUCD. This is what we have in common. Do we have a name for it? We don't. We could make up a name, and we would embody, each of us would embody the name. We could go to the European Commission and say, we are name, our common goal. We do not need, we could use a structure, formal structure. At the very minimum, and the less conflictual cooperation common factor would be to have a name that we share and on which we bank. So my conclusion, maybe redundant with what I said, is that I'm convinced that at present laws are made at the European level and not at the national level. And that if we make sure each of us in every country can provide a flow of raw information that captures most of what we are working on one hand, and if we share a name, that will be enough to create cooperation that does not conflict with the tendency that we have to be willing to be independent. And the other dilemma that I forgot about. So thank you for listening, and I hope I pass the message, even if I did not convince everyone. Do you have questions? Yes.
Yeah, I think actually I did know the EU CPP, though I raised my hand, so I didn't know, because now it's bringing echoes in my head. A couple, I don't know how to call it, a couple comments, let's put it this way. One, tactically, I don't think it's a very good idea to try and in a sense, link the fight against this particular directive with the kind of it's a supranational build-up that's going on in Europe at this moment. When you're saying things such as, we have the possibility of writing national laws is fading, which is essentially what's happening in these supranational entities such as Europe, you're mixing two very different problems. And unless you declare yourself as anti-European, I don't think it's very, very good for your fight. I mean, you're building in something way too broad to get to the level you're reading.
I completely agree. I must say that before coming to LSM, to Rencontre Mondiale, I did not know what I was going to say now. I could not possibly know. I had to talk to other people from all over Europe. And this talk is definitely not a talk to convince people. It's a talk to people already convinced.
No,
so,
wait,
yeah.
Wait, I'm not entirely convinced.
Okay.
I've been approaching that thing from an entirely different angle because I've been interested in other things recently, namely open access to scientific publishing. Okay, and the European Copyright Directive is extremely important in France for a very simple reason. It would introduce into France something that the French don't have, which is called fair use, which means that, for example, for educational purposes, for a parody, for what do you call this, quotation needs, you could do that as a right, not as a permission. Present
that's
present
not right. For France. For France, it's not correct.
What do you mean it's not correct?
I mean, it does not become, it's not becoming a right. It's still an exception, and it even the
right.
Exception as it exists now is broader than what it's
well,
becoming.
It's the educational exception.
There is no educational exception. Yeah, the in France the law proposal narrows everything.
Well, of course, and you know why? Because French publishers have been lobbying like
sure.
The French government
yeah.
to try and exchange that exception
yeah.
against and put on your safety belt against the right to private copy, which is a French right right now.
A French exception, but
no,
treated as
well,
a right.
If you call it all that as exceptions,
yeah.
But
well,
they are used.
Yeah, exactly. It's a
access.
Very well-established exception,
right?
But I get your point. Is that if I insist too much on the fact that France has no power over laws, then it's not helping them, where they could do good things. They could adapt. In fact, they have the freedom to adapt the EUCD in a harmless way.
Exactly.
Definitely, they have this power. What I see is that it's not happening.
Publishers have been lobbying very, very strenuously, very strongly.
Yeah.
Apparently, your form of lobbying has not been effective enough yet.
Yeah.
You know? That's where the battle is. But when you push on this thing, you know, please be careful where you push and what you really want to get. And you might want to coordinate with beyond the software communities, for example, to reach into the library communities.
That we did, yes.
You know,
yeah.
Educational sectors and all that. Link up with international bodies that do the same thing.
That we did not do.
Europe, you know.
Well, to some extent, we had a few contacts with Robin Grass and with other European initiatives. But it was
North America. You might want to look at Spark and ARL for the librarian
yeah.
and such things. But I don't want to do a lot like that.
Okay.
And
Joao.
Just the things. One thing is that I don't know if it happens in another country, but in Portugal, since the beginning of the 90s, there have been judges applying directives as law. Directly to directives, not national implementations. And I know that started in France. So I'm not sure if that's happening in France or not as a generalized movement. But that happened in Portugal.
Well, as you mentioned, that point struck me. In Portugal law, if you are to implement a directive by doing a cut and paste of the directive into Portuguese law, you do not even need a vote for that. That's what you, yeah, correct?
It's not that simple. It's supposed to be like that, but you can never do it at the place. There is a particular authorization that the parliament can give to the government, and they usually give it to implement any directive. And usually the government uses that to add something else that was not on the directive.
Okay.
I wanted to comment on those exception versus rights things, because one very important thing on the UCD that most people are ignoring when it goes to the exceptions is that there is a paragraph that says that those exceptions are valid as long as they don't economically affect the right holders. That is in most implementations, and that is on the directive. Most people are ignoring that paragraph. That paragraph is extremely important.
Are you talking about the three-step test?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's an important dimension we cover in the video as well. So the principle of it should be enacted also then.
So are you saying that in effect, because it's been on the books for a long time, the way it's being applied will not really affect treating this as a class of one?
Well, the fact is, in France, this subject of the three-step test came up sometimes, but it didn't trigger many discussions because most lawyers and judges and lawmakers treat that as inapplicable, just to be ignored. It's you don't think about it anyway. It's not usable. So that struck me, but apparently it's the case. More question?
Yeah, well, I understood that you wanted to give some messages to all your fellow partners, potential partners in other countries. But for the regular sympathetic human being that want to help you, what can we do? If we don't want to dedicate too much time and energy, is still a possibility to help?
Well, what you can do currently, and that's my opinion, but maybe other people could shortly state their opinion, relay information between countries. This is what I find most useful at the moment, relay information between countries. I don't know if Martin or... yes, Robin? An advice, someone else? An advice to, no? Okay, another question maybe? Okay. Ah. Yes.
Could you please
Could you speak louder? I did not get it. Yeah, there is a chance. But I wouldn't bet yes. Thanks for the advice. Yeah, sure. Okay. Well, what's absolutely incredible in the French implementation of the EUCD is that it forbids transmitting information related to circumvention of technical measures, where the EUCD does not forbid that. So it goes even further. Sorry? No, the EUCD does not forbid that. But France decided to add that if you transmit information that you have a reason to think that it might be useful to circumvent part of a technical measure, it's a counterfeit. You're facing 150,000 euros penalty and 2 years of imprisonment. Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
A short pause, break, 5 minutes before software patents issues with François. And Loïc will give another talk tomorrow afternoon about the UCD.
Yeah, regarding this talk, I don't know yet what I will be saying at this one. If people